Welcome to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Bernstein. And today we are going to dive into a little known piece of pro sports and true crime nexus point that is a fascinating tale of when a up-and-coming pro boxer runs into the Black Mafia and the Italian Mafia in Philadelphia, and fate is not so kind. I want to bring on Sean Nam, one of the country's leading writers of the pro boxing game, and somebody that has become an expert in the story we're about to tell and wrote a great book on it called Murder on Federal Street. Sean, thank you for joining.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So, I'm just going to give a quick primer, then I want to throw it over to you to talk about how you got interested in the case and talk us through your process and everything. So for people that might not know, Philadelphia, one of the greatest boxing cities in the world. Being a Detroiter, I grew up big boxing fan. We had the Kronk gym here. I grew up following Tommy the Hitman Hearns and all the great Kronk boxers. Obviously, if you go back even further, you got Joe Louis, Sugar Ray Robinson. But Philadelphia, is one of the it's a breeding ground. It's so fertile for not just great fighters, but great punchers, guys that had a lot of power and were just brawlers. Interestingly enough, the guy we're going to talk about didn't really fit that mode. His name was Tyrone Everett. They called him the Mean Machine or Ty Butterfly or Ty the Butterfly. Started off as a featherweight, ended up as a junior lightweight, and was a real big up-and-comer in the 70s, and got a title shot, and controversial decision went against him. This was in late 76, and then within a couple months, he was dead, murdered on Federal Street, which is a, pretty iconic thoroughfare through a certain part of Philadelphia that had a lot of Black Mafia presence. And there's still a lot of questions about why he was killed, how he was killed. His girlfriend shot him, caught him in bed with somebody, but it isn't maybe all that it meets the eye. So that's the quick primer. And saying that Tyrone Everett wasn't a big puncher. He was more of a guy that would try to win fights on points, so he wasn't, beloved by people that were trying to sell tickets necessarily. Sean, let's dive into it.
Yeah, I mean, that was the interesting thing about Tyrone. He was part of this really rich kind of culture of prize fighting that had been kind of the work of the promoter J. Russell Peltz. Peltz is who's still around and was really instrumental in kind of helping me piece together that kind of history. The bread and butter at the time was, you meet in the center of the ring and you bash each other's brains out. I mean, that's why you went to a fight. You didn't go to a fight. You didn't pay for a ticket to see two guys dance around.
Yeah.
That's a lot more common today.
Look at Floyd Mayweather, man. Mayweather.
Accepted. Yeah, Mayweather became what? The highest grossing fighter of all time.
Yeah. Doesn't knock people out.
And, back in the day, you didn't have that kind of television subsidization. You didn't have the kind of commercial framework. And so you had to appeal to the Tom Brown, and you got him to come to these fights. Based on guys who liked to punch and who could take a punch. So I'm thinking of guys like Benny Briscoe, who in a lot of ways typifies kind of hard-nosed Philadelphia spirit, blue-collar guy, hard hat, and
so some of my favorites were like Meldrick Taylor, Timmy Witherspoon.
Yeah, obviously, later on, absolutely.
Joe Frazier, obviously.
Yeah, Joe Frazier. Yeah.
And then Bernard Hopkins is, maybe the GOAT in that city.
Absolutely, yeah. And so you could argue, some of the richest kind of middleweight fights took place in that era in the 70s. And Tyrone was not a middleweight. He was a lightweight, you know, fought at around 130 pounds. Again, he was not a he was not an aggressive fighter, but he showed flashes of that in some of his fights. He had power. He didn't like to use it too often. He was a defensive guy. And that drove his promoter nuts, you know, because he saw the potential. And what complicated this was the fact that he was actually insanely popular as a local guy. You know, we talk records. You know, at one point, he was the second highest earner in Philadelphia after Benny Briscoe. And the title fight in which, you know, he was allegedly cheated out of a victory, that is still the highest kind of indoor attendance for a prize fight in the state of Pennsylvania to this day. There's something like 16,000 plus at the old Spectrum. And
it was against Alfredo Escalera, right?
Alfredo Escalera, yeah.
From Puerto Rico. And it's interesting that we got that Tyrone got the title shot in Philadelphia as opposed to having to go to Puerto Rico to fight the champ Escalera.
Yeah. And by that time, you know, Everett basically established himself as
a draw.
A draw. Yeah. And you could bring somebody like Escalera who fought on the road. So it was not new for him, you know, and he was kind of an itinerant guy who, you know, fought in Japan and other places. Tyrone had this backing, and this backing, you know, was from South Philadelphia. And, you know, there are, you know, we'll get into the Black Mafia at some point, but, you know, when I spoke to Peltz and, you know, there are other kind of news reports that would reference kind of the demographic of the crowd, and they were, you know, they were dressed to the nines, you know, think of your favorite black exploitation film, and you think of some of these, you know, really flashy kind of high rollers kind of coming through. And, you know, Peltz told me, you know, that was, we knew that Everett had kind of his street affiliations and friends, and they all showed up, and, you know, they made a point of really supporting their guy. And so, you know, it's not enough to say that he was a fighter who was talented. He was a popular fighter. And, you know, think about the average price fighter, and think of it this way. You go to a Tyrone Everett fight and you would hear women, you know, cheering, you know,
yeah. Known as a ladies man.
He was a good looking guy.
Right. You know? Which makes his demise even stranger. We'll get into that in a second. Yeah. Just for, you know, before we get into some of the meteor stuff, let's give some context. And you've already started to color it up, but in Philadelphia, in pro boxing at this time in the 70s, I mean, the mafia controlled the whole thing, or virtually the whole thing. They had their claws into the different sanctioning bodies and different regulatory bodies. So in Philadelphia, you had some real famous gangster / boxing puppeteers. Frankie Carbo, Blinky Palermo are two of the most legendary. And they were in the middle of some of this. And there was a guy named Anthony Ferrante, who they call Tony Meats. He was a big boxing guy. And then I'm going to turn it over to you. Then you had the Philadelphia Black Mafia guys that worked with the Italians. But it seemed like, from reading your book and from doing a little bit of due diligence on my part, it seemed like Tyrone Everett was dabbling on the side, fronting some of these Philly Black Mafia guys money for drug transactions and so forth. So you had this milieu of criminality that kind of surrounded Tyrone Everett. Now, Sean, take it over.
Yeah, well, I would say that by the time the 70s, rolls around. So you're referencing the mob influence on boxing. But after the early 60s, after the Kefauver Senate hearings, mm-hmm. it's considered that by that time, you know, the organized crime groups that controlled boxing were basically gone.
But, okay, so this was a time when they had lesser if
they were, yeah. Influence. I mean, by the time Tyrone comes up on the scene, Russell Peltz, you know, for somebody who's getting into boxing as a former journalist, he thinks the mob is a thing of the past. You know, it's their, you know, it's what you see in film noirs. It's, you know, that's a thing of the past. So, but
is that true? I mean, that kind of flies against some of my research that had the mafia involved all the way. I would say by the 90s, they were out, but in the 70s and 80s, they might not have held the weight that they held up and through the 50s. And 60s.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think like the kind of, maybe the broad stroke, the kind of visibility that they had in any case wasn't as apparent.
Pronounced.
And, yeah. But you're right, though, that, you know, Frankie Carbo, obviously, but the main guy is Palermo, who crawls back into boxing in the 70s. And yeah, I mentioned this title fight. That's where, you know, Peltz recalls seeing, you know, Palermo at the airport after the fight. And, you know, there's a controversial judge in the fight who scored it against Tyrone. And he said, you could buy this guy for a cup of coffee.
Right.
And you see another associate of Palermo, a guy named Honest Bill Daly, who was part of that whole syndicate back in the 50s, but he was not indicted. And he is also part of this picture. And so, yeah.
Is this fight too
gone? Definitely not. And in a lot of ways, it seems like they had their imprint on this title fight that a lot of people thought Tyrone won, but it didn't go his way.
We should let people know the fight was on November 30th, 1976. We said it was at the Spectrum. It was for the WBC junior lightweight championship belt, Alfredo Escalera versus Tyrone Everett, who at the time was undefeated.
Yeah. This was a week or two after the premiere of Rocky.
Right.
Which is a kind of cool
coincidence. It's noteworthy because Rocky took place in Philadelphia. I can imagine the place was just, would have been buzzy, but you add the Rocky element into it.
Yeah.
You must have been able to cut the tension with a night. It must have been electric.
Yeah. Yeah, so this happens, and you know, everybody's devastated. Peltz, Tyrone's manager, Frank Gelb, who interestingly would later become kind of the head guy at Atlantic City for boxing fights when Atlantic City started coming into the picture. And they were just, you know, stunned. And Peltz, at the time, was, you know, he would admit that he was naive. He thought they had done their research on the judges. There was no way that the hometown judge would score against Everett. It was kind of this wink-wink thing that you figured, okay, if it got close, you know, our guy would take care of us. It was, you know, it's almost kind of an unwritten rule in boxing in a way. But the fact is that Tyrone, if you look at the film, and I believe there's footage of it back up on YouTube, it's pretty clearly a win for him. You know, he kind of handled this guy the way that he does best, which is kind of the box on the outside and you know, counter him. And so when, you know, after this kind of debacle, it's kind of, I think I call it a stain, kind of the Philadelphia boxing scene. And, you know, it's only 6 months later that, you know, he's found on the second floor of his girlfriend's house on Federal Street, bloodied, bullet rammed up his nose. He died within minutes, according to the coronary report.
So May 26, 1977.
Yeah. Yeah. So you had these two kind of tragedies for a fighter who was all of 24, 23. And a lot of people thought might have had a good chance to make it to the Hall of Fame. You know, he's just getting started.
He's one of those great what could have been stories. He's probably the fighter from the city of brotherly love that is the most legendary fighter that nobody knows about. Maybe even, you know, before becoming a legend, but had the trajectory to become a legend in a legendary fight city. I talked to over the last couple of weeks, I've talked to a couple of people that, you know, you bring him up and if you're from Philadelphia, you're a boxing fan, you immediately know who he was. I didn't know who he was until I picked up Sean's book last year.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that the notoriety that he had locally compared to what could have been on a national level. But it's also noteworthy to say that he won two fights after the fight against Escalera. So in those 6 months, he actually fought again and won. And he had set up a rematch with Escalera. It was going to be in Puerto Rico.
Right, right. And that was to be promoted by Don King.
Right.
Who had gotten control of Escalera at that point. And so on one theory, the fixed fight, if you will, for the title fight was a way for Don King to get into the picture, who at the time was doing a lot of things in Puerto Rico. And, you know, it was like a battle between Don King. And then you had Bob Arum, who was Ali's kind of first promoter. Eventual promoter. You're not alone. I would talk to fighters. I would talk to, you know, so-called hardcore fans, and this name was simply not registering, you know. And as I was going through my research, I realized this guy was a big deal. And if you were in boxing circles at the time, there's no way you didn't know this guy. I start the book off painting a portrait of the funeral scene, and it is complete chaos. They're reported, you know, several thousand people, kind of out in the streets milling around, and, you had all the bigwigs in town. You had Rizzo, you had
Frank Rizzo, the police chief.
Yeah. You have Frank Rizzo, you had Joe Frazier, you had some big names come through and pay respect.
Also, Philadelphia Black Mafia guys were at the funeral.
I imagine so.
Yeah, I talked to some people. They said that there was...
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to talk. I guess for your readers, when I'm writing the story, I don't make the connection yet between this possible affiliation with the Black Mafia until later on. And when I do, that's when I realize, okay, we've got something here because we can bring something new to the table, because the story about Tyrone Everett had always been, okay, the streets got a hold of him. You know, he couldn't get out of the streets. He was like Hector Camacho. It was the same kind of circumstance. And I always wondered, like, well, so what does that mean? What did that entail? And so the Black Mafia for me was a way to put kind of a face to this faceless entity, you know. There had been a lot of, I think, misconceptions about how he died, that he was in bed necessarily with another man. And those are details that came out from the kind of prosecution, from the defense side. And so I thought, okay, well, how did I stumble on this? Well, I think there are a couple of things. Ricardo McKendrick.
Yeah, so that's let people know that. Sorry to interrupt you, Sean.
But no. You probably know better than I do, Scott. I mean, Ricardo McKendrick is one of the chief figures of the Black Mafia. And
he was a real hard-hitting enforcer type. This was a guy that knew how to make money, but was also really feared.
Yeah, cutthroat.
Ricardo McKendrick, they called him Ricky. Some people called him, I think, Slick Rick or Big Rick.
Yeah.
And he was like somebody that was in the inner circle with Sam Christian and Ron Harvey, who were the founders of Black Mafia family. And when Sam Christian died at some point in the last 10 years, McKendrick, who's still around, was one of his pallbearers. So this is a guy that had his bona fides. And McKendrick's, and again, I'm going to turn it back to Sean, but just to color it up for the audience. Tyrone Everett was known around town as a ladies' man, dressed quite flashy, driving a Cadillac, a lot of different women on his arm. After he died, there were rumors circulating based on the fact that the prosecutors were saying that he had been in some type of compromising position with a man in the minutes before he was shot to death. But there were some rumors that were going out that he had possibly had some bisexual proclivities. But nonetheless, he was in a relationship at this point with Ricardo McKendrick's either wife or soon to be ex-wife. Mm-hmm. And it potentially put them at quite serious odds. Now, go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, precisely. And that's, that was the kind of context that I've been missing. There was a news report about how during the trial was intimidating the chief witness, who's also alleged to have been the man that he was in bed with. It was also
Terry Price. His name is Terry Price.
Exactly. Yes. And and who had been under the employ of Carolyn McKendrick, mm-hmm, to sell drugs. All the drug stuff got swept under the rug during the trial for prosecutorial reasons, but that had always been like a kind of big tell. Like when they found Tyrone in the home, they found 39 carefully packaged packets of heroin. Yeah. So this was that they weren't just, goofing around. This was meant for distribution. Ricardo, going back to Ricardo. So, Ricardo came up in the news again some 15 years ago, nearly two decades, for being involved in what is still the biggest cocaine bust in Philadelphia history. You might want to fact check.
Yeah, it was like, that's what it was called at the time. It was like $200 million worth of, it was like 200 kilos, $200 million worth of drugs. It was, I'll get the specific. But
yeah,
it was really.
It was with his son.
Right. It was his son, Ricky Jr.
Ricky Jr. And, I think one of the reporters I saw, Kitty Caparella, who actually wrote some news stories on the Tyrone case back in the 70s, wrote an article on this drug bust and mentioned Carolyn McKendrick. I'm like, whoa, okay. And then,
275 kilos.
There you go.
That is a huge, that's a cartel-like seizure from a property in Philadelphia.
Yeah. So, and then one thing led to another, and I discovered Ricardo in Sean Patrick Griffin's book, Black Brothers, Inc. And that reading that book allowed me to piece together a lot more things. Again, I'm kind of reading tea leaves at this point. But I felt I had enough context now to present this and potentially change and shape the way people have thought about this story. And, you know, there have been follow-up stories over the years from various reporters who would attempt to do kind of a recap. Understandably, you know, it's, you know, you had the fixed fight and you had the slaying, and the Black Mafia never came up. That term never came up, even right. though, it was, well known, I think, at least by law enforcement. And they had done stories in several of the big papers in Philadelphia on the Black Mafia. You know, decades later, this had all been kind of forgotten in a way. Again, I think if you look at the details of the case of Tyrone's involvement with potentially the wife of, you know, one of the leading members of really brutal criminal organization, really smart one as well. It's hard to look at this and be thinking, okay, maybe you weren't as immune and hot as you thought, you know, because, you know, Tyrone was feeling pretty good about himself at that time. But, you know, as one kind of source I was able to talk to for the book, who was the son of one of the members of the Black Mafia, he said, just from an optics standpoint, it looked bad. You know, in the case, the reason, so Carolyn would end up doing, I think, about 5 years. I think she was sentenced to 10. But they were able to drop a lot of the charges based on the fact that they had witnesses who claimed to have seen Tyrone beat her in public and in private. And so let's say that's true. If you're Ricardo and you're getting bits and pieces about how this hotshot boxer is messing around with you, not only messing around with your wife, but is
pretty pretty like not being shy about it.
Exactly. He's out. And, you know, how's that going to fly? So that's where, you know, by the time I speak to Tyrone's younger brother, Eddie, it's clear that a lot of people believe that Carolyn necessarily was not the murderer. And if she was just the trigger person. So that was a conspiracy that, or at least a theory, let's say, that a lot of people in the kind of South Philadelphia area believed at the time. And it's still something that Eddie subscribes to this day.
What is your knowledge of, I know I'm kind of jumping all over the place here, but in the aftermath of the Escalera fight, let's say going into December 76 to the beginning of 77, is he making a fuss about this? Is Everett making a fuss? Or is he doing like Raging Bull, where he kind of knew he had to, as much as he was opposed to it, he knew he had to swallow the loss in a fixed fight in order to get the championship in the next fight?
Yeah, it's interesting. It, you know, early on, it seems like he takes this pretty well, and he's pretty placid, almost unusually so. But later on, there's a reporter, a guy named Tom Cushman, who's kind of the boxing beat writer for the Daily News at the time, a great writer, really chronicled that era extraordinarily well. And he brings up a meeting that he had with Tyrone, I think the day before he died, and how Tyrone was basically believed he thought there was a compromised judge in his locker room at the night of the fight, and a quick switch was made from one judge to another, and it was clear that he was still very upset. And there's a different conversation that he had with his manager, Frank Gelb, where he tells Gelb, listen, sometimes you got to get, or I think he's relaying a conversation that he had with Gelb to somebody else. Basically, you know, you got to get dirty sometimes. And that Frank, you know, Frank is from Winfield suburbs, a really prosperous suburb of Philadelphia. It's like you... some things you're just not going to know, and you have to get dirty, and you have to kind of get into the streets, and you have to kind of play them, whoever them is, at their own game. So there's a lot of indication that Tyrone is pretty cynical at this point, and maybe thinks he needs to, go to a different direction.
I know there was also a, some informant chatter that McKendrick was responsible for a number of, and again, this is all alleged.
Yeah,
Ricardo McKendrick has not been charged or convicted of any homicides, but that McKendrick was one of the people that were tasked with getting rid of not just enemies of Philadelphia Black Mafia, but people within the Philadelphia Black Mafia power structure that maybe weren't towing the line. I know one of the guys that he's a top suspect in the hit was a guy named Bud. I think his name was George Abney. They called him Bo Abney, who was a Philadelphia Black Mafia shot caller. So this is a guy that had at least a history of being investigated for homicides.
Right. And Abney was a guy with his head cut off or something. Was that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. We've talked about it before on the show. We actually had Sean Patrick on a couple weeks ago. I mean, this is the brutal of the definition of raw brutality. When you were talking about the Philadelphia Black Mafia of the 70s and early 80s, there was nothing really romantic about it the way that some of the stories of the Italians had always been in terms of consumption from the public. This was like you took all the pomp and circumstance out of the gangsterism, and it's just like I said, raw, unadulterated criminality and ruthlessness.
Yeah, and I think that's why I thought it was so important to bring up this context, because of the violence that they were capable of. I mean, your readers, listeners probably know, the Hanafi massacre in D.C. Yep.
With Kareem Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's property.
Yeah, and the Dubrow furniture I think attempted fire. Some of these, there was like, they weren't trying to get money. It was just the brutality was the point.
Yeah, right. They were making statements with their behavior.
Yeah. I can read this quote to you. This is what Tyrone's brother told me, so that's like messing with Scarface's girl or the Godfather's wife. You're between two mafia families. They were vicious families. So, in fact, Carolyn's family, the Swint family, was also pretty much heavily involved in kind of the underworld as well.
Bo Abney was he was decapitated, was a Black Mafia member feuding with another Black Mafia member. I believe it was Cadillac Tommy Farrington, who he was supposedly had stolen some narcotics, either or drugs or money, and they were fighting over certain territory where they were dealing. Mm-hmm. 1974 murder. So this was 2 years before Everett, but McKendrick was a top suspect in that. Never charged. Mm.
Scott, are you aware where McKendrick might be now?
He's not dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when I was talking to Sean Patrick, and he's the undisputed kind of godfather of this reporting. I mean, he contextualized all the reporting from the 70s that was very, you know, macro, and, you know, in the moment, and, you know, almost 20 years later or 20 or more than 20 years later, he wrote out a book that was just, you know, it's the Bible when it comes to studying the Philadelphia Black Mafia family.
I just want to point out, I don't have this book in its current permutation without Sean's book.
Yeah. He's the one who introduced me to all of this and has helped me in my research on it. And he's been great. But I think we might diverge, me and Sean, in our theories from, let's say, the 80s forward, let's say from the late 80s forward. Let me back that up for a second. Late 90s forward. He's of the opinion, and again, just what I hear is a little bit different from what he hears. So I'm not saying I'm right or that he's wrong. I'm pointing out that we have a little bit of a divergence here. He's kind of saying that, you know, JBM, which was the Junior Black Mafia family, which were the young teenage gophers and errand boys and proteges of the original Philly Black Mafia in the 70s. When all those guys went to prison, Junior Black Mafia, led by these guys that had been mentored by the Philly Black Mafia, popped up and became more of kind of like a crack distribution organization more than a fully formatted criminal enterprise. But he kind of says that according to Sean Patrick's research, he says that all of that activity really stopped after the JBM busts. And my research tells me, even though I'm not claiming that there's some giant hierarchical organization left, but I know from my reporting, from talking to, you know, frankly, top guys within the Philadelphia mafia, both Black and Italian. One, I don't have a problem telling you because he's dead, and it's known that I was trying to, at one point I was authoring his biography. It was Ralph Natale, who was the boss of the Philadelphia Mafia in the late 90s, was doing business with them until late in his reign run. So that puts it all the way up into the early 2000s. But I think there are still pockets and smaller crews tangentially connected to other crews that are made up of old JBM guys and possibly some old Philly Black Mafia guys. And again, I don't think it's some type of vertically integrated organization where there's money flowing up and down, but there's still something there. And these guys work with the Italians in some capacity. And I know that there were some points in the late 90s, early 2000s, where there was some dust ups, like potential, I don't want to say war, but there was one incident where, some of the Junior Black Mafia guys were upset with the Merlino guys, and they rolled up on and Merlino's front porch.
When was this?
This was 98, 99, maybe early 99 before Joey went to prison. I wrote about it. I'll send it to you when you get off air.
Yeah, my understanding comes from Sean's research, is that JBM or the Black Mafia, I should say, that by the time it's the mid 80s, they're kind of completely defanged.
But I guess, and I'm saying my research doesn't necessarily jive with that. Could just be a timeline thing. I'm not trying to, again, I defer to Sean and guys like you who are more kind of boots on the ground than I am. But and I guess some of it's semantical too. Like what's considered defanged, what's considered an operational organization.
Right.
If a bunch of guys from a previous organization are still operating together, are they an organization?
Right.
So I think some of it's semantical. But I know what I can say for sure is right at this very second in the 2020s, there are guys that were at least high ranking members of the Junior Black Mafia that spend time, at least socially, with Joey Merlino and all of his boys. Mm. I hear there's some illegal activity going on and in the background of that. That's neither here nor there, I guess, but Tracy Mason and Benny Goff and some of those other guys, they still hang out with Joey Merlino, and they're not shy about it. You go on social media, you can find pretty recent photos of Tracy Mason and Joey Merlino.
Yeah, that must be a completely generational thing, though.
Oh, yeah, I'm just saying that it's not, if people think that these groups are either gone or opposite or not intersecting anymore, or people from organizations that used to be aren't intersecting with other current functioning entities like the Merlino or the Scarfo Bruno crime family. I think they're mistaken.
Mm.
But again, I would defer to Sean Patrick, on most of this stuff. And I think some of what I'm saying could just be timeline distortions, not necessarily that we're, or semantical things, not necessarily that we're disagreeing at the core of the research.
Right.
But yes, like you said, it wasn't that long ago. I think it was 2008 that the McKendrick senior and junior got caught in that raid. So it was 15 years or 16 years ago.
Yeah, and my understanding was that they maybe struck a plea deal. I mentioned in the book that I was able to track down Carolyn. Fortunately, we weren't able to have an actual conversation on the record for the book. But that's kind of, in a way, my white whale, is to get that side finally. So perhaps down the line. But it is just fascinating how, you know, this group has kind of persisted for so long.
And transcend, at least in terms of culture, has transcended. You know, one thing I've never really written about, but I know it's out there. I might write something about it at some point, but Will Smith, the Fresh Prince, you know, he was tied up relatively closely with a JBM boss named Bucky Davis. Bucky got killed at the peak of the crack wars. And what I have written about at length is that, you know, you can trace a lot of the Philadelphia music scene in the 70s, the Philadelphia, the soul sound, and a number of the major Philadelphia R&B soul recording artists were linked business-wise, not illegal business-wise, but legal business-wise, linked to certain members of the Black Mafia family.
Mm.
Or that's just, I should say, not BMF, the Philadelphia Black Mafia, specifically Bo Baines, who was a boss.
Right, I think Bo Baines who appears in the documentary.
Bo Baines is the one who took over from Sam and Ron. And he was working at one of the record labels in Philadelphia that was handling some of the artists. Maybe Teddy Pendergrass was one of them. I apologize for missing out on some of the details here. I know one guy was, I think Stan the Man. Does that sound own the record label? I'm sorry, I'm going down a rabbit hole here. But these are groups that have intertwined with, you know, pro sports and boxing and music for quite a while.
Yeah, actually, I asked Sean about that one time, the Pendergrass connection, because there's like an internet rumor that the Black Mafia was behind his death.
Yeah, I don't believe that part of it, but I do believe that he was doing some business with them, like in terms of the recording industry.
I think he was saying that he never came up once in the kind of the records. So, but it is it's just fascinating. It's you know, in a lot of ways, very few people know about this organization. Although I think it's definitely achieved some notoriety, at least the past couple of decades.
It's called Philly. It's called Philly Groove Records. And the owner of it was a guy named John Watson, who they called Stan the Man. And Stan the Man Watson had affiliations with the Black Mafia. And Bo Baines was close to him. And Bo Baines was high up at the record label.
I just want to read a quote from the book, again, by a member of one of Black Mafia founders or leading members, who kind of grew up with Rick Jr. And knew Ricardo McKendrick. Rick was living in Federal Street basically as a single man. That was the running joke. He had young women running in and out of his home because Jr. had fixed up the place pretty nice. Little Rick put about $50,000 worth of renovation into the house. That's kind of like if you've ever seen the movie Coming to America. It was a beautiful place when I saw the place around 90 to 92. There was a spiral staircase, and we're talking about South Philly Row House. This is where Rick Sr. was living. So he had a little palace in the ghetto, essentially.
Yeah. It's like gold faucets in a place that barely has water.
I believe that was a home. So when the drug bust comes up, you know, they find cash in this house.
It was on Federal Street, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? That with that link 40 years or, you know, 30, 40 years later.
Yeah. It's fascinating. And there's so many things I want to know more about. But, you know, we'll have to see.
You know, I know here in Detroit, there was a kind of a similar situation happening with Kronk. Not a lot of people know about. Everybody knows about the legendary Kronk Jim and Manny Stewart, and that he was able to produce, you know, the most amount of championship fighters from any trainer or gym. I think he put out 45 world champions or something. And there was a lot of Italian and Black mob influence in Kronk. Manny Stewart was at the center of more than one federal racketeering drug investigation. Never arrested or convicted, but, you know, kind of like we're talking about with Tyron Everett and how that his fights would attract that kind of crowd. Tommy Hearns, his entire entourage was Murder Row and YBI. And Murder Row and YBI in Detroit was the equivalent of Philadelphia Black Mafia. So you can look at newspaper photos, even videos that you can find on YouTube of Tommy Hearns walking to the ring in the late 70s through the 80s. And I can tell you, the people behind him, how many bodies they all have. So he was immersed in that life as well. And Kronk was, so what I'm saying is, I think even though some of this stuff hadn't been reported or hasn't been reported or people don't know about it, I think this was going on in every major city, probably in every major gym to some degree.
Yeah, I talked to
last thing I'll say, and I want to get your comment on it. I talked to a lot of ex-Kronk fighters, guys that sometimes held belts. And a lot of these guys, it didn't matter how much money they were making as fighters. They were still investing money in street activity.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know that about the Kronk.
Well,
connection. Yeah.
Again, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole. But Daryl Chambers, God rest his soul, Daryl Dynamite Chambers, major contender, came up with Tommy Hearns and the whole Kronk Gym crew. He swallowed 25 years for Manny, and I got no problem saying that right now. He's dead. Manny's dead. And Daryl died last year. He only got about 3 or 4 years of freedom, but he was the scapegoat for the entire Kronk Empire's dirty dealings. They needed a scapegoat. And in the early 90s, after 10 years of investigations into Manny and Tommy Stewart, Manny Stewart and Tommy Hearns, they indicted three fighters from Kronk, one of them being a very prominent middleweight champion, Donald, the Lone Star Cobra.
Donald Curry.
Yeah. And Donald beat the case. The other co-defendant flipped and testified. Sure. And Daryl ended up refusing to give the feds what they wanted, which was Manny Stewart and Tommy Hearns. And he had stuff to give them. And Chambers went and got sentenced to life in prison. And I helped, his campaign to get freedom and got out, lived 3 or 4 years of freedom, and then passed away of a heart attack last year. But he is the poster child for when being a professional boxer dovetails with being a drug dealer and it goes wrong. Mm. Just like Tyrone Everett could have been.
Yeah. Hector Camacho comes to mind as well. It's funny. You talk about these kind of the legacy of the Black Mafia. You could maybe do a whole book just about their relationship with boxing.
Yeah.
Mike Tyson's wife, Kiki Spicer Ali, is none other than the daughter of yet another high-ranking Black Mafia member, Shamsuddin Ali.
Yeah.
Who I think in many ways was kind of the ideal Black Mafia member. He did the street work on one side, and then he was dealing with and hobnobbing with kind of the politicos on the other.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, I think he was also one of the pallbearers at Sam Christian's funeral some surveillance of him and McKendrick at the funeral in 2016-15.
Wow.
Yeah. So lives today, man. Well, this was awesome, Patrick. Patrick. This is awesome, Sean. No, I'm calling you Pat. Who's Patrick?
We
were just talking about Sean Patrick. That's why I said.
Yeah.
So Sean, tell everybody where they can pick up the book and where they can read you and consume anything that you got coming up.
Well, the book you can probably, if you were requested with any local bookstore, you could get it. They could get it for you. It's obviously on Amazon. There are a few Barnes and Nobles in the kind of Philadelphia, New Jersey, and in that area. I have a full listing if you have a website for the book. It's just the title of the book, murderonfederalstreet.com. And that'll have links that'll take you to buy the book. I have, like, the only social media I use is Twitter or X, which is my name, SEANPASBON.
Well, this was awesome, man. Thank you so much for coming and sharing this. You know, we take pride here at the OG Pod where we want to get into the nooks and crannies and find all the diamonds in the rough in terms of storytelling. And
I love it. This, yeah, I love the nooks. I love the crannies.
I say all this time. Yeah. I say all the time. And I know that these are cottage industries. And I can only read so much about John Gotti, Al Capone, and Whitey Bulger. Like, those three people seem to take up all the oxygen in the room when it comes to telling.
Sure.
This kind of, and
sure.
I just, there's so many great stories like this. And thank you for coming on the OG and sharing it and talking boxing and talking Philadelphia and Italian mob, black mob. This is my sweet spot.
I love it. Anytime.
Thank you, sir. You're always welcome back on. And we'll exchange contacts and I'll geek out with some of my boxing knowledge with you. Awesome. in the near future. All right. Thank you, Sean. For Benny Behind the Glass, thank you for producing. And for everybody that likes OG Pod and Gangster Report, our companion web magazine, please spread the word, share, like, subscribe, and we will keep bringing you the great true crime content that you expect. For Sean and Benny, Scott Bernstein, OG Pod out.